How do our environments shape who we are and how we care for the world and each other? There are many solutions to climate change, inequality, and poverty around the world. How can we learn from them and transform our society?
The project that I'm writing towards is always the project of reminding the reader and myself as I do my own research to make these works that we are in a complex and delicately balanced relationship of connection to everything else on the planet. I think of it as one of the gifts of neurodivergent thinking is this idea of spiderweb thinking, where we begin to recognize and write into and speak into the complex interdependence and interconnection of every gesture that we make on the planet. So when I'm thinking about the ways in which we have this cultural story of the pristine Earth, right, or the Earth we've never messed up, the thing that humans were at some point, we were really good stewards and we didn't make any changes. I think that tells a lie that still places us in kind of a very Christian-centered perspective of there's us and then there's everything else. And I think most storytelling that I really respond to, whether it's from my own culture or from previous civilizations, is storytelling that acknowledges that we are in this complex relationship where every gesture we make is connected to the lives of every other creature on the planet.
I think meditation, whether it's prayer, walking meditation, just looking at nature and engaging with those things, it allows you to transcend. I mean, if I can go back, some of my favorite transcendentalists is Emerson and Thoreau, and how they were able to go in nature and experience a shift in their perspectives.
Well, everything I've done has come out of a sense of place. Most of the people I write about are obsessed with where they live and the natural world around them, and they're inspired by nature becomes a symbol of the spirit, right? So every natural sign in the world, a tree, a rock, a bird, is somehow emblematic of a larger, complicated universe. And so I think young people should get out into the world, go hiking in the woods, sit under a tree, listen, don't try to be somebody, try to be nobody, and then something will happen.
I'm constantly inspired by how people just want to do better by their peers, that they want to ensure that we all can live in the societies that we live in together. The kind of generosity of spirit that I encountered throughout interviewing people constantly feeds my hope, if not optimism. When we talk about the natural world, I had this moment when I was in Costa Rica, and bodies of water are often where I feel most connected to nature. In Los Angeles, whenever I was able to go to the ocean, and I remember so fondly the times that I've spotted dolphins and felt quite emotional whenever I did. Here I live off the Thames River. But in Costa Rica, I was swimming off the Osa Peninsula, which is one of the most biodiverse places on Earth. I was swimming with the sea turtles and with other sea creatures. I just felt so connected to the broader natural world. It really highlighted to me the importance of policies like Costa Rica's biodiversity law that are as much about conservation as they are about seeing human communities as key parts of the ecosystems that we live in order to ensure that they last for generations of not just
non-human animals, more than human life forms, plants, the ecosystem itself. It's trying to present as much as possible narratives and language and thought processes for us to absorb as people that state emphatically and with a lot of joy that every action we have has another action, and so too the actions of the more than human kin that we live with. It's that interconnectedness that we lose when we have a story of humans that can either do wrong or right, and then everything else, right? It's that integration that we need to be able to take in. It's not new. It's not original to the work I'm doing, the work of other writers doing this kind of work right now. But I think it's fallen out of the way that we think about ourselves in relation to the planet and in relation to the culture we've built. And I think the more narratives that we allow to be complex in that way and to be interconnected, the more that we begin to change our brain chemistry around how do we protect ourselves and also everything that is in relation to us.
So this is the beginning of my chapter entitled Public Lands. Before I started thinking about land, the word land conjured scenes for me of evergreen forests, rushing white water, and desolate expanses of tundra, places that are mostly unsullied by human touch. Land meant nature. I also imagined the frosted peaks and flowering meadows of the Rocky Mountains because I grew up right where their foothills fade into prairie. It's here, inside Banff National Park, that I learned to ski at the age of 4, gliding down the gentle slopes, following my father through the whitewashed landscape like a little duckling. Soon, we were cutting sharp angles down steep slopes inflamed with bumpy moguls, but I don't remember feeling afraid. Easy when you're a kid. Powder cushions most of your tumbles. Chairlift is a ride at Six Flags, swinging your moon boots and skis like pendulums as you're whisked effortlessly over a carpet of frosted treetops. Then you race down the longest slide you'll ever know, for as many runs as you can sandwich into an abbreviated winter day. It's still my strongest association with the idea of public lands. Not all properties owned and managed by government are intended for public use. Military bases, for one, are tightly guarded, for instance. But national parks are potent reminders that our nations are tied to our lands, and our governments steward them for the people. In democratic nations, these governments are also accountable to the people, distinguishing them from conservation land trusts or any private landowner. We, the people, have some control over how we use and benefit from public lands. Like many Canadians and Americans, I have primarily thought of our public lands as places of minimal development for visitors to admire or for outdoor recreation. The mountains were a childhood playground. It was true in summertime too, hiking up to turquoise glacier lakes, camping in the alpine forests, playing Franken games of hurtling over logs, capture the flag, and limboing under dangling branches. People travel from far-flung corners of the world to witness the Rocky Mountains, Canada's most iconic landscape in its most popular national park. In fact, national parks make up only 3% of Canada's landmass and 4% of America's, but their symbolic value far exceeds their acreages. Once, out of curiosity, I asked my Malaysian dad how a poor immigrant from the Asian tropics got into hiking and downhill skiing. "These are very Western things," he chuckled. "Only people with money can do them." I shrank a little, suddenly aware of how my own relationship to these places say far more about my place in the world than it does about the land. Yet experiences like mine also guide how our governments manage our public properties.
This narrative that we have that there's an ecosystem and it's either broken or whole, and we either have ruined it and we don't have to worry about it because it's ruined and we can just keep ruining it, or it's fixed and we can't really touch it anymore. Those binary relationships to the way that we regard the planet are part of the problem. When we start seeing ourselves in a constant relationship to the gains and losses of conservation, because you can have a great win and things can get a lot better and then they can be reversed by politics or changes to the environment, the more that you have that evolving relationship with it that's dynamic, that's alive to the moment you're in, and that's not afraid of the feelings of fear or hopelessness or grief or pain that attend paying close attention to the world as it is evolving around you, the better we are able to be flexible in the relationship we need to form with fixing what we can and holding on to what we have. The more we rely on that black and white thinking of either we're in grief or we're out of it, we've got a loss and we have to move on, or we don't and we're fine, the more that happens, the more difficult it is to flow into, I think, what we really are going to need in terms of emotional flexibility to get through the staggering changes that are starting to happen as regards climate issues.
I mean, my two last novels, and particularly A Separation, which is set in the southern Peloponnese in the Mani region, landscape is incredibly important, and it is a novel that is set shortly after wildfires have decimated the landscape. And I mean, it's by no means climate fiction, but part of the instability that the character feels is because there have been these fires and there has been mass destruction and economic instability in the both literal landscape and social and cultural landscape of Greece. And that is something that she's trying to understand as she arrives there. In Intimacies, which is set in a more urban setting, one of the most important emotional scenes takes place on the beach when the character, having spent, you know, 6 months or something in the city, for the first time realizes that this landscape is actually one that she visited a very long time ago with her father, who has passed away at the opening of the book. And suddenly in that moment, in inhabiting that landscape, she's able to reconcile pieces of her memory and pieces of her past that she hadn't been able to reconcile earlier. And that's actually an experience that happened to me. I wrote the first draft of Intimacies and this scene that's on the beach in the very end of the book was not in the draft. The entire time I had the sense that the city was familiar to me, but I didn't know why. You know, I did a research trip there and I did all the writerly things where I marked the house where I thought the character would be living, and I did her commute between her home and the court, and I, you know, went to different restaurants. I did all of that research. The entire time I thought this city feels a little bit familiar to me, but I don't know why. It was actually only when I finished writing the book that I realized I had spent 2 summers there as a child with my family. And I'd had these very powerful memories of being on the dunes with my father when I was a child. And for much of my adulthood, I didn't know exactly where that memory had taken place. I didn't know the geographical location. And suddenly I realized that it was actually in The Hague. And then I, you know, put it into Google Maps and I suddenly was able to say, oh, that's that amusement park that we went to a couple of times. And this is where we lived and that's that. And it was a really astonishing experience of suddenly having some piece of my past, these memories of my father who did die over a decade ago, suddenly having them anchored in a concrete place, and they had a new reality to me. That was very, very powerful, and that took place in landscape.
I love mountains to bits. You might see them in everything I do, but I love mountains, especially when mountains are devastatingly huge, like elders, and they're looking down on this tiny, fleeting particle that I am. I like to be overwhelmed with awe, and mountains do that very well. They overwhelm me in a good way. They allow me to see that I'm not as important as my head thinks I am.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
We hope you've enjoyed this program. To hear more from these guests, listen to their full interviews.
These interviews were conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. This episode was produced by Mia Funk and Tom Logan. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.